Safety First, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Myanmar and Bangladesh sign a deal for the return of Rohingya refugees to Myanmar. But what about the violence that those refugees fled from?
First of all, obviously, is safety. Our concern is that they will be safe from the kind of violence that they fled.
Meanwhile, Rohingya refugee camps in Bangladesh continue to grow.
5 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago, this was a forest that's now become people's home, you know, sheet by sheet of corrugated iron, of bamboo walls.
And later, are Norwegian, Danish, and Swedish really different languages?
So sometimes there's a joke that Norwegian is Danish spoken with a Swedish accent. So that's how close they all are.
That's all ahead here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us on this Thursday, Thanksgiving Day here in the U.S. We're going to start off today's show in Bangladesh. That's where more than 500,000 Rohingya refugees have fled to. The Rohingya people are a Muslim ethnic minority, and they've been fleeing violence in Myanmar that U.S. officials now describe as ethnic cleansing. Today, Bangladesh signed an agreement with Myanmar for the return of the Rohingya. We wanted to hear more about this deal and how it could work from someone who's been on the ground as this refugee crisis has unfolded. So we reached out to Carolyn Miles. She's with the charity group Save the Children, and she just returned from an aid trip to Bangladesh.
My understanding of the agreement is that there will be very small numbers repatriated. It would take, in fact, years for people to go back. So there's going to be a crisis in this area of Bangladesh for many years to come.
Do the Rohingyas, do they get to choose who wants to return, or will some simply be sent back?
I believe that the idea is they'll get to choose, and I think it's unlikely you'll have a lot of people choosing right now, given what they went through when they were in Myanmar, to return. I don't know that that's really going to happen.
At this point, do you think that the Rohingya Muslims who fled their country to escape violence will be better off because of this deal? I mean, is it in their interest to return at this point?
You know, I think it's tough to say that. I was there a couple years ago, and at that time, in the central state of Rakhine, hundreds of thousands of Rohingyas were living there, and they were living in really difficult situations and conditions, living in IDP camps. Their movements were very restricted, so they didn't have the ability to actually move around, and the conditions were quite tough. So I don't know that this agreement is actually going to give them either the rights of movement or that the conditions are going to be much better than what they fled.
Do you have a sense of how the Rohingya Muslims who are in Bangladesh now are responding to the deal? I mean, are they interested or wary?
Well, I think they're going to be quite wary. In talking to families, and we sat and talked with many of the families in the camp, in the settlements, and, you know, when we asked them about going back, Frankly, they had this look of fear, I would say, on their faces. And given what they've been through, I think that's quite natural. And none of them said that they thought that they would be able to go back anytime soon. This was before the deal was signed. So I do think they're going to be very wary of going back.
What do you have to hear about the details of this deal to think that it's a good idea? I mean, are there issues that you want the deal to address before any Rohingyas head back?
Well, I think the most important thing that would have to be addressed is that those returning, they would have to have some ability to move within the Rakhine state, and they would need to have their basic needs met. So would there be food available, healthcare available for them? Would they be able to work inside of these areas, wherever it is that they're going to be resettled? So I think just basic rights and needs are the most important things for these families that are going back. And, you know, protection of the population, the violence and the burning of villages and all of the things that have happened to them while they've been there. Certainly, there'd have to be protection against those things. And the military would have to agree that there were going to be protective conditions for these people.
Carolyn Miles, she's president and CEO of Save the Children. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
The port town of Cox's Bazar is a famously beautiful tourist spot in the southeast corner of Bangladesh. It's also where a mega camp of Rohingya refugees has sprung up, according to Shelley Thackrell. She's with the United Nations World Food Program.
5 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago, this was a forest that's now become people's home, you know, sheet by sheet of corrugated iron, of bamboo walls. You know, families live side by side. Some families are fivefold, some families are up to eight and more.
Shelley, I looked this place up, Cox's Bazar, where you are. It's right on the coast. It looks like a big beach town. Describe where you are.
Carol, you're absolutely right. It actually hosts some of the most beautiful beach coastline, 125 kilometers. It's probably the longest beach coastline in the world. You drive one way and to your right is this never-ending marine drive with the coast and the sand to the right. And then the camps themselves are an hour from where most of us stay in town. And the camp has just grown. It's grown exponentially. It's, you know, it's now what we call a mega camp. And the Bangladesh government has been really gracious, has really opened their borders to these people who are fleeing.
I know this corridor has been a place where you mentioned, you know, for years now, Rohingya refugees have come to this part of Bangladesh. Are there Rohingya refugees there in Cox's Bazar who've been there for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years?
I mean, there are people here that have been here for 25 years since the late 90s as well. You're seeing now a generation of families, of Rohingya families who've been here for 25 years, for 2 years.
So it's now Cox's Bazar has really become their home. They're kind of settled there, many Rohingyas. Any other particular story of a particular refugee in their personal story that might bring home for us what life is really like for these refugees when they come from Myanmar?
We've recently conducted a study which says that one in four Rohingya children is suffering from malnutrition. And this is, you know, food is not enough to beat malnutrition. You know, we need to improve health on all levels, sanitation and hygiene, as well as the quality of nutrition. So if, you know, if you can imagine these some 700,000 families living side by side in such a close proximity in this mega camp. And we're in the dry season now. We're in a season now where we probably have 3 or 4 months where the weather is on our side. But, you know, but there is always a potential of cyclones here. Once the monsoon starts, you know, that's where roads become impassable. It becomes very difficult to navigate the roads here.
That just has to be dramatic. I had no idea that there were so many hundreds of thousands concentrated in one small area. I imagine that Rohingya refugees, when they came into Bangladesh, were going to different places.
And this is the challenge. I mean, the challenge is the mega camp. The challenge is clean water, is sanitation, is disease. UNICEF is currently conducting a measles campaign. You know, there are pockets of the camp which are probably more prone to, you know, open water where water will just sit. The weather has actually, in the last few days, it's dropped significantly in terms of the temperature. You know, a week ago, the days were just baking. It was heavy, heavy sun. And, you know, families make this treacherous journey by foot from Myanmar, escaping the persecution there. Some tell us that they've walked for 6 days, they've walked for 10 days, they've walked with, you know, just the bare possessions that they have. So there are people arriving every day, and we're trying to kind of get life-saving food to them. We get biscuits to them. We get hot meals to them. They're given shelter. So, you know, we're trying to do everything to really make sure that, you know, whatever trauma that they've encountered, that they have something here which helps them settle into something that's dignified, into something that makes them feel welcome and makes them feel that they are being looked after.
The UN World Food Program's Shelley Thackrell. She's based in Cox's Bazar in the southeastern corner of Bangladesh along the border with Myanmar. Thanks so much, Shelley.
Thank you.
In the mid-1970s, thousands of indigenous Hmong people started coming to the U.S. They were refugees from the Vietnam War. Many of them settled in Minnesota, now home to a large Hmong community. Ye Vang is part of this story. He came to the U.S. as a refugee, and today he's a chef specializing in Hmong cooking. But being a culinary emissary can get tricky. Here's reporter Nancy Rosenbaum of KFAI Radio in Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Our rice is ready to roll, brother.
It's a rainy, miserable afternoon, but Chef Ye Vang isn't complaining. He's cooking outside under a white tent.
We don't have much to complain about. Our parents had a across the Mekong River to get here. A little rain never really hurt anybody.
Fang is Hmong and co-runs a catering business that specializes in Hmong cuisine. Today they're serving Hmong elders and younger people at a farm. Fang is prepping sticky rice, roasted vegetables, and grilled meats.
Grab the chicken out, and we can lay the chicken on.
Fang wants to share stories about the Hmong people through food. The Hmong have never had their own country, and for generations they lived as nomadic farmers in Southeast Asia and China. But Fang, who's 33, has spent most of his life in the Midwest. Eating cheese curds is part of his Hmong story, too. So as a chef, Fang has struggled to prove himself to some Hmong elders, who he says are skeptical of his take on traditional food.
Oh, Choma! Case
in point, two older Hmong farmers watch as Fang cooks chickens over a wood-fired grill. Soon, they start asking him questions. Fang translates the conversation for me.
What did they say?
They're like, oh, this isn't done. The flame's not big enough. It's like, how is this ever going to be done on time?
Fang's cousin and business partner, Chris Hurt, chimes in.
Is there more food?
Is there more food? Is this it? And, you know, like, I'm so used to it now.
So, like, if we were at a Hmong party, it would be, like, all of our aunts.
It would be all our aunts.
Telling us how to cook it.
Yeah.
Fang moved to the U.S. when he was about 5. His parents didn't speak English and held strong to Hmong traditions, including food. So while other kids played Little League, Fang's dad taught him how to butcher a pig and grill meat over an open flame.
To be given the tong to grill or flip the meat was like this huge kind of rite of passage. And when I was young, my dad, like, I think he had to run in and go grab something, and he handed me the tongs, and I was just like, what? And literally, I was just like, okay, like, don't mess it up.
Later, Fang worked at restaurants in the Twin Cities, and he's now trying to put his own stamp on Hmong cuisine, like adding beets to his dishes.
What do you have here?
We have a fire-roasted beets, carrots, and onions. So it's all root vegetables.
Even though many of the farmers Fang's serving tonight grow beets, Fang says that Hmong people usually don't eat them.
We get a lot of our own people will criticize and say, well, that's not Hmong food. Like, why would you use beets? Hmong people don't use beets. And I would challenge them, and I said, you know, when our parents and our grandparents lived in Laos and Thailand, they used what was around them because it was about survival. And us being here in the northern Midwest, wouldn't we do the same thing?
This is Hmong style, so...
Yeah.
Finally, it's time to eat. Fang wonders if the elders will appreciate his twist on Hmong food.
It's fun to watch the reaction in the face, like, especially with the older generation, especially, like, that roasted vegetable dish. It's just like, okay. Like, so you're like, will they like it or not?
Before long, the food is gone, and some of the farmers return to the fields wearing bright headlamps. Fang stays behind and chats with his friend Tico. He tells her about his signature hot sauce. If you've eaten Hmong food, then you'll know that pepper sauce is key.
Tico, do you know what we call our hot sauce?
What do you guys call it?
We've labeled it a tiger bite sauce.
What? Dude, that's a bomb name.
It turns out that tiger bite has a particular meaning for Hmong people.
The literal translation of tiger bite is like the worst curse you can give somebody. It's like a bad word. Like, I can't even to this day say it in Hmong. And I still don't have the heart to tell my parents that it's called tiger bite sauce. I'm just like, oh yeah, it's just our pepper sauce. So weird. But a lot of our like non-Hmong speaking people are like, oh, I get it because it has a bite, right? We're like, yeah, because it's got a bite.
Fang wants to sell his tiger bite sauce. He also wants to open his own restaurant, just like his nomadic Hmong ancestors. He's looking for a permanent place to call home. For the World, Nancy Rosenbaum, Hastings, Minnesota.
Is it a dialect or a language? And when does a dialect become a language? Well, that depends on history, politics, and power. Coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. And for the rest of our show this Thanksgiving, we're going to do something a little different. First, let's bring in Patrick Cox and Nina Porzucki.
Hey, Carol.
Hey, Carol. Happy Thanksgiving.
Now, you may recognize them as the duo behind our language podcast, The World in Words. We regularly feature extracts from the podcast on The World, but today and tomorrow we're going to bring you full-length, never-before-heard-on-the-radio episodes of The World in Words.
Well, almost full-length. We had to make a couple of edits to make way for the newscast coming up.
So a little tweaking here and there, but what have you got for us?
Okay, so today we are going to touch the third rail of language podcasting.
Sounds a little dicey.
Yeah, it is. That is making the distinction between a language and a dialect.
Yeah, that can get really contentious. A few podcasts ago, for example, we talked about the Italian writer Elena Ferrante and the Neapolitan dialect, except that some of our listeners wrote in to tell us that Neapolitan, in their minds, is not a dialect, but a language.
So what makes a language and a dialect? This is a question that I asked to a bunch of linguists and language experts.
As a linguist, I will not engage in trying to define language and trying to define dialect.
That's linguist Bojan Belic, and he is definitely not alone.
I don't think any linguist feels like a sense of physics envy because they can't classify, you know, every variety of speech in the world as either a language or a dialect.
Lane Green writes about language for The Economist. Not even a little? Not even a little bit of envy?
A little bit. Some days, maybe. It depends on the linguist. But, I mean, if you look at the color spectrum, red turns into orange by a series of very fine, basically continuous gradations. So at what point does red become orange?
That's a really tough question. I mean, at what point does red become orange? When does a dialect become a language?
So our quest to answer that question begins in Scandinavia.
Do you know it's sort of like a crime series called The Bridge?
Charlotta Guskins is a linguist at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, though she's originally from Denmark. Danish is her mother tongue. She's a big fan of the Danish-Swedish TV series The Bridge. Now, you might have caught the U.S. adaptation of the show. It took place between the U.S. and Mexico. But she's talking about this Danish-Swedish original series.
A bridge between two worlds.
You know, there's a bridge between Copenhagen and Sweden, so you can drive across the water from Denmark to Sweden.
A bridge between good and evil, and between two cops of two nations.
And in the middle of this bridge, there's this body found. And because it's precisely on the border of Sweden and Denmark.
What looks like a single crime.
The police from Denmark and from Sweden are involved in finding the murderer.
Turns into high-tech serial killings, threatening all of Scandinavia.
So they speak Danish and Swedish during the whole series to each other.
And this delights Charlotta because this is exactly what she studies. No, not murder, but mutual intelligibility.
You must have been excited speaking mutual intelligibility.
Yeah. Yeah, I use it a lot as an example to show that how it works.
Mutual intelligibility is one factor that many people use to distinguish between a language and a dialect. Except Danish and Swedish and Norwegian are all mutually intelligible languages. Big L.
It's funny you mentioned the bridge because I remember when that bridge opened and there were all of these great anecdotes about the differences between Danes and Swedes, how they had approached building the bridge and how they communicated while they were building the bridge, which was completely mutually intelligible, but they kind of had some fun with slight different variations on words that they use for various technical terms.
So Swedes, Danes, and Norwegians, according to the economist Lane Green, he says that they call their respective tongues neighbor languages.
They are neighbors. They're close to each other. They have an entwined political history. They were all part of a single union once upon a time. Then they split up. And for most of that time, Norway was part of Denmark. And the language of Norway was essentially Danish spoken in a different way. And then for 100 years, I think, or so, Norway became part of Sweden and then became independent.
And this term neighbor languages makes it all sound so very cozy or, dare I say, hygge. But it wasn't always so cordial and cozy. As Lane Green pointed out, Denmark and Norway was a political union from the 14th until the 19th century. And the written language of Norway during that time was actually Danish. So then in 1814, we're getting into a little bit of history here, Norway was more or less handed over to the Swedes. And this second union lasted for almost another 100 years until Norway gained independence in 1905. And during that near century of rule under the Swedes, the Norwegians debated how to distinguish their written form from Danish. So there were two camps. Should they go back to written Norwegian, the Old Norse of the 14th century before Danish rule, like so way going way back, or should they just Norwegianize what already existed? And that schism still is playing out in Norway today.
But despite all of this history and these occupations and all of that, Swedish, Danish and Norwegian, they're all totally recognized as languages, right? Not as dialects.
Exactly. And here's how Lane sees it.
So they have this complicated political situation, but now they're very friendly. And there's lots of travel, lots of people who live in different countries, marry across the lines and so forth. And there's this concept of neighbor languages because it would be odd to call them foreign languages. Written Danish and written Norwegian are so close that they're just – it's just like one slightly spelled differently. Swedish is more different still. The Swedish speech sounds a lot more like Norwegian speech. So sometimes there's a joke that Norwegian is Danish spoken with a Swedish sound system or Swedish accent. Uh-huh. So that's how close they all are.
What I find really fascinating is without having to worry about distinguishing their languages as different enough to be languages and not dialects, mutual intelligibility becomes, you know, an asset for these neighbor languages. It knits the region together in the sense, you know, politicians in the region, they regularly meet and they speak in their languages with ease. Business people can easily communicate. I've even heard, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Patrick, but of Danes and Norwegians and Swedes becoming life partners and never even having to learn their partner's language.
Yes, that's true. I know of people who, what they get better at is understanding the other's
the other dialect, side.
The other side, but they don't jump over and speak it.
Right. Linguist Charlotte Guskins, she calls this ability to sort of speak across languages receptive multilingualism.
But there's always a linguistic term for these things.
Exactly.
Receptive multilingualism.
So Charlotte, she thinks a lot about how receptive multilingualism works and how you can actually measure mutual intelligibility.
How different should languages be before they are languages?
That's the biggest question. What is mutual intelligibility? What does that even mean?
Yeah, some linguists suggested we can just measure how well can people understand each other. But of course, that's also a problem because we don't know how well should people be able to understand each other for them to be speaking different or similar languages.
So she's not exactly measuring when orange becomes red, right?
No, not at all. She's saying it is super complicated. And even if you could measure it, you'll find that there are many, many ways and many different ideas of how to qualify what is a language and what is a dialect. But after the news, a simple story about how we got here in the first place. You're with The World in Words on The World.
I'm Carol Hills. Languages evolve over time, and purists complain about that. Take the writer Cicero in ancient Rome. His writing was considered the gold standard for Latin.
And even Cicero himself in that time was criticizing the quality of Latin around him. So those complaints are ancient. They're literally ancient.
Languages versus dialects, ahead on The World. Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. And today we're handing the rest of the show over to my colleagues from our podcast, The World in Words, Patrick Cox and Nina Porzucchi.
Right. And we are trying to find out what is the difference between a language and a dialect. It's something that even people who study linguistics, they don't really like to talk about it. And if you were listening just about 10 minutes ago, you'd have heard linguist Bojan Belic say this.
As a linguist, I will not engage in trying to define language and trying to define dialect.
The analogy is it's like a color wheel. There's orange and there's red, and the two blend into each other. But at what point does orange become red, or vice versa? The same is true for language and dialect. When does one become the other? But perhaps the bigger question is, how do we get here in the first place? What accounts for the language/dialect labels to begin with?
It's story time.
Ooh, story time. You know what they used to say on BBC during like Children's Hour on the radio? They'd say, are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin.
Are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin.
Once upon a time, there was a group of people. Just people. They lived in a valley.
Were they farmers?
Oh, yeah. They were farmers. They were big, big spinach farmers.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Made them strong.
Very strong. And they lived their lives, and they grew their spinach, and they raised their children, and they spoke the way they spoke. And every Monday, they set up a market at the crossroads with people from the neighboring valley.
Dairy farmers?
Yes, dairy farmers. So the spinach folks and the dairy folks, they'd get together. And though they spoke slightly differently, they could pretty much understand each other. And all was well and good in the valleys.
Sounds like a very wholesome place.
Very totally. It's really healthy. Then one day, some folks came from a city far away. They heard rumors about this, like, bounty of spinach and cheese, all organic and unpasteurized.
Uh-oh, I don't like where this is going.
No. It wasn't bad at first. These city folks came. They had a funny way of speaking, but, you know, they figured out how to communicate enough to buy their spinach and their milk and their cheese. And then they went away again, back to the city, feeling pretty content.
I knew this wasn't going to turn out good.
Wait. So the city folk came back for their farm-to-table fare, but this time they brought more city folk, who brought the leaders of the city folk. And the leaders told the farmers, hey, we like what you're doing here. We want to help you. So we're going to tax you, spinach and dairy farmers, but in exchange, we'll protect you from the cattle ranchers three valleys away. And we'll also do lots of other stuff, like make schools for your children and teach them about the world. Oh, and we'll teach them our way of speaking. It's sort of like your way of speaking, but better and more official. See here, we can even write it down. We have whole libraries of our speech. What do you have?
The original concept of language was really a function of literate societies.
This is Lane Green again.
When you call something a language, you tend to see grammars and dictionaries on a shelf, you know, the Berlitz Guide to French. And if there's a literature tradition, we tend to think of it as a language.
This idea that a writing system makes a dialect a real language, it goes back thousands of years, according to Lane.
Already in ancient Rome, you had classical Latin, and you had people writing in Latin, and that gave speakers of Latin, that gave them a sense that this was the real language, and any deviation from, say, the way Cicero wrote was erroneous. And even Cicero himself in that time, this is already 2,000 years ago, was criticizing the quality of Latin around him. So those complaints are ancient. They're literally ancient.
But the thing that cements this idea that written languages are somehow more legitimate comes with the rise of the nation state.
What you get when you get the rise of the nation state is the idea that there's one real variety, standard High German, standard Dutch, standard Flemish, standard French, whatever it is, and that everything else is a deviation from that. When in fact, the standard Dutch and the standard German and the standard French we know today were just dialects that won a race. They happened to be the dialects of certain important people at the point at which the state became the main game in town. The rise of writing, the rise of printing, the rise of governments and so forth gave these randomly chosen dialects. The Romance language spoken around Paris, the variety of German that Luther translated the Bible into and so forth, these became our templates for the standard language and gave us this newfangled idea that there's only one real language and a bunch of bad copies of it out there. And those are those dialects.
And the nation state, time and again, has used this perception to denigrate dialects.
When the French Revolution happened, right after the revolution, the revolutionary leaders wanted to take a census of what people spoke around France. What they found was only about a quarter of the population of France was able to use proper French, the written prestigious form spoken in the court and in Paris, and only about 5% of the population, I think, spoke that as their native language. So the whole operation for the next 200 years in France was to use the power of the state to crush out that diversity. As the revolutionaries would put it, they were liberating and giving to the people an opportunity to speak this universal, logical, beautiful, wonderful language called French. So the rise of the nation state is very intimately linked with an explicit desire to make France more homogenous and to get rid of, as much as possible, a bunch of the diversity of France.
France, of course, is not alone in this. Many nations have used an official language as a tool to knit a country together. Look at Italy or China. Language has also been used as a means to break a country apart.
Good evening. Though nothing is considered safe in the former Yugoslavia, the outdoor market in Sarajevo seemed safe on this sunny morning until a shell landed in the midst of
the former Yugoslavia. Throughout the 90s and into the early aughts, ethnic cleansing and violence ravaged the region as this former communist state broke apart. The U.S. and NATO got involved.
All the ingredients for a major war are there.
Bill Clinton was president.
And in the center of it all, a dictator in Serbia who has done nothing since the Cold War ended but start new wars and pour gasoline on the flames of ethnic and religious division.
And in the midst of the wars on the ground, there was also a war of languages. Serbo-Croatian, the official language spoken in Yugoslavia, broke apart as the country itself broke apart. Each new nation declared its own official language with its own official name.
Okay, my name is Robert Greenberg. I'm a professor of linguistics and a dean at the... No, I'm sorry, I should do that better. I'm not used to doing this. Okay, can I try that one more time?
Sure thing.
My name is Robert Greenberg. I'm a professor of linguistics and dean of the Faculty of Arts at the University of Auckland in Auckland, New Zealand.
Robert Greenberg studies and speaks... Well, I'm not even going to try. How would you define it? How should I even call the language?
Well, our traditional new way of calling it, which is the tradition of about 10 years, is Bosnian, Croatian, Serbian, so BCS, or some people add M for Montenegrin, so some people say BCMS, but most people say still Bosnian, Croatian, Serbian.
Robert first began visiting the region when it was Yugoslavia and not BCS. In 1989, he went to Croatia.
And you could sort of feel trouble in the air.
Robert was staying with some Croatian friends of a friend.
They were very kind, very generous people.
And they were also nationalist, leaning towards the breakup of Yugoslavia and an independent Croatia.
They took me to one of their favorite places, which was the Mirogoj Cemetery in Zagreb, not too far from where they lived. And we stumbled upon the grave of Ludovit Gaj, who was a Yugoslavist in many respects. He was one of the leaders of a more pan-Slavic movement in the 19th century. And my friend, who had been talking all this sort of nationalist Croatian talk about how they need to be independent and all, knelt down very emotionally near the grave and talked about it in moving terms, like, this is a person I really admire. This is a person that really wanted the best for us.
So wait a minute. If I've got this right, there's this nationalist friend of his who is a Croatian nationalist. He wants
right.
the breakup of Yugoslavia.
Yes.
And he's crying before the grave of a 19th century figure who symbolizes Yugoslavia, who symbolizes
right.
the unification of the
right.
Balkans. I mean, that makes no sense.
I know. It's totally strange. But to understand just how strange this is, it helps to know a bit more about this 19th century figure, Ludovit Gaj, and his influence on the Serbo-Croatian language. And I use that old name purposefully here because Gaj is actually responsible, in part, for helping create Serbo-Croatian. Again, here's Robert.
In the 1830s, he was leading essentially the cultural movement. At the time, the Croats were very much under the rule of the Hungarians, part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and they were trying to Hungarianize the population, you know, make them learn Hungarian as their main language. And so this was first a cultural movement to assert a sense of Croatian identity and language.
Meanwhile, the nearby Serbs are also living under the rule of both the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Ottoman Empire, and they're also battling for their language and identity. So the Croats and the Serbs get together.
And they signed an agreement in Vienna in 1850 to create a joint literary language for Serbs and Croats, a joint standard, let's say, in popular terms. And that's sort of what we would call the origin of Serbo-Croatian as a unified language. And it was born out of both these political motivation to join forces against, you know, these stronger empires that were dominating these peoples, but also the fact that some of the same dialect was prestigious for both peoples, and therefore it seemed to make sense to these romantic intellectuals at the time that they should join forces.
Boy, so Serbo-Croatian, the language of the former Yugoslavia, that, it was just a construct itself.
Yes, which was amazing to me when I found this out. It was formed, as Robert explains, by the desire to gain power and assert identity, which is exactly why nearly 150 years later, Serbo, Croatian, Serbian, and Croatian were broken apart.
Wow. So the Serbian and the Croatian and these other languages,
Bosnian, there too, Montenegrin.
Right. I mean, how close are they all? Is this like Scandinavia? Are they closer or further apart than Danish, Swedish, Norwegian?
Well, as we've learned, mutual intelligibility is a slippery slope. It's hard to measure. But here's how Robert describes it.
Before the breakup, there was a scholar named Kenneth Naylor, and he wrote this article in which he says that Croatian and Serbian are not that different from British English and American English. So I think you mostly, and I can mostly understand somebody in Great Britain speaking. I can understand people in New Zealand. Occasionally, of course, I don't, right? Occasionally, there'll be expressions. I had one here where somebody told me they're going to go to the panel beater. And I said, what on earth is that?
Remember, Robert lives in New Zealand.
It's basically the car body shop where they fix your car. So, you know, you just have these different forms. And so there are occasions where I might not understand a whole expression or a whole sentence. What has happened in former Yugoslavia is linguistic intervention or engineering, where you intentionally make your language different. So one of the things that Croatia definitely did when it became independent, it was changing much of its terminology for anything that is administrative politically, like regions are not called by the same name they were called before. Words like passport or identity card, a lot of those sort of administrative bureaucratic terminology changed. And then they adopted some of the older Croatian words. Serbia might have an international word like ekonomika, and Croatia will have their own word, gospodarstvo, or something like that. So they'll use a local word instead of an internationalism. And then sometimes you could have real sentences where you don't understand each other.
Wow. So it really does sound pretty similar to Scandinavia.
Right.
That they just seem to be dialects of one language.
Or neighboring languages. So I spoke with a Croatian translator. Her name is Ellen Elias Bursac. And according to Ellen, when Croatia was a brand new country, the first Croatian president, Franjo Tuđman, he was responsible for bringing back a lot of words that were used, you know, pre-Serbo-Croatian, but then also for creating new words.
There were funny words like the word for helicopter is helikopter and had been, but under Tuđman, he introduced the word zrakomlat, which means an air beater. And it became this neologism joke. People would refer to zrakomlat people as people who were using too many neologisms, that they themselves, by speaking, were beating the air with their neologisms.
Wow.
Yeah, wow is right. And in Bosnia, things are so delicate that there's now this famous anecdote that I love about a package of cigarettes. So on the package, there's, you know, the typical warning, smoking kills. But the warning is virtually the same in written Bosnian, Croatian, and Serbian, except Serbian is in Cyrillic. But it's been translated three times onto the packages of Bosnian cigarettes into each language, so no one is left out. Well, except the Montenegrins, but that is an entirely different story.
Wait, so you mean that it's the same sentence three times?
Exactly. It's the same sentence written out in Bosnian and Croatian and Serbian in Cyrillic. But it's the same words, just in Cyrillic. So we're going to take a break for a minute now, but when we come back, we'll hear how all of that played out in the War Crimes Tribunal at The Hague, and maybe, just maybe, finally figure out at what point a dialect actually becomes a language, or a language becomes a dialect. I'm Nina Porzuki.
And I'm Patrick Cox, and this is The World. Today, featuring our podcast, The World in Words. And we're trying to figure out the difference between a language and a dialect. When does one become the other? Before the break, our quest took us to the 1990s and the breakup of the Balkans.
It's been more than two decades since the wars in the region, but it's still a very, very sensitive issue. Even to the point that this past March, a group of linguists from around the region and around the world, they wrote up this quote-unquote declaration of a common language, basically declaring, you know, we are neighboring languages, maybe we are all related. And it just, you know, created a firestorm of criticism from politicians, from people in the region. Still,
but you just couldn't say that. We've just been to war with each other, so we can't possibly claim that we have a common language.
And in fact, even that the name BCS or BCMS, Bosnian, Croatian, Montenegrin, Serbian, notice that it is in alphabetical order. Everything is very, very intentional. And this term I learned, BCS, was a construction that was coined by the International Criminal Court in The Hague during the War Crimes Tribunal because they had to have a way of referring to the language. And Ellen, who we just heard from, she witnessed this firsthand. She worked as a translator with the War Crimes Tribunal for 6 years.
So imagine a courtroom setting where your defendants are from different parts of the former Yugoslavia. The witnesses are from various regions of the former Yugoslavia, and everybody else is speaking English or French. Anything anybody says is being interpreted all the time.
Were there sensitive issues around, you know, the different languages, like when a defendant was Bosnian?
Lots of issues. For example, especially early in the tribunal, many of the defendants were Bosnian Serbs. And a Bosnian Serb, if asked, what language do you speak, would say Serbian, normally. But the fact of the matter is that the way a Bosnian Serb speaks is the way all the people speak in their town. And the Muslims living in that same town would say they speak Bosnian. So when the people selecting interpreters received requests that the interpreter needed to be working into Serbian, they would find somebody working into Serbian, a professional translator into Serbian from Belgrade, and that's a different way of speaking than the way they speak in Bosnia. Plus, the victims who were testifying, the witnesses, were frightened when they heard Serbian spoken because they associated Serbian language with the atrocities they'd experienced. And so people would clam up and they'd stop speaking in the courtroom if they heard Serbian coming over the earphones, interpreting for them what was being said in the courtroom. So it was a delicate situation. What's interesting with all these differences and so much discussion about differences that goes on between Croatian, Bosnian, and Serbian is that there was very, very little debate in the courtroom and protest about not understanding what was being said.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Like, in a practical setting like this, even though people were insisting on different, these all being different languages, in the end, whatever you called it, it didn't matter. The words made sense to everyone.
Yeah, everybody understood. And interpretation in the court was pretty smooth, according to Ellen. She said that even the interpreters developed kind of an almost like a neutral hybrid of everything, kind of like what we would call like a mid-Atlantic accent, per se.
Hmm.
Also, the judges discouraged a lot of discussion about languages because they were nervous that this would turn into this thing people would be flogging constantly, you know, saying, oh, you know, I can't understand this because of this or whatever. In the very few instances, I think there was one famous one where one of the defendants really tried to use, I didn't understand what was said because it wasn't in my version of the language.
She's talking about Serbian politician Vojislav Šešelj here, notoriously provocative during his more than 11 years on trial in The Hague.
The judge said, I'm sorry, I understand that, in fact, somebody who grew up as you did during Yugoslavia, where the language was Serbo-Croatian and it was shared, you were exposed to all these things and you do know these things and you do understand them, and we're not going to tolerate these discussions. There were 10,000 sessions of court, not days, but sessions, 2 3-hour sessions of court in the 20 years of the work of the tribunal. And there are virtually, except for that one defendant, Vojislav Šešelj, there's very few instances of defendants complaining about language and not understanding things. And he famously said, well, I'm sorry, I don't understand this word točno, which is the word for accurately or precisely. And the word that he would use would be tachno, which is just the difference between an O and an A. And he was making fun. He was being, he was being
accurate.
Exactly. He was trying to use it to be kind of a buffoon.
A buffoon and a nationalist, just making a point to point out that his mother tongue was a separate language. Schuschel, by the way, was acquitted last year. His acquittal is now under appeal.
Okay, so have we worked this out? Do we know now when red becomes orange?
Take it away, Lane.
People want a clear-cut answer to what's a language, what's a dialect. But anybody who's kind of deep in this subject will tell you, look, there's a lot of subjectivity here. And what we're really talking about most of the time is political.
Patrick, when you call it orange, it's orange.
Oh, it's like the old I know it when I see it thing, right? Except it's not. It sounds like, I mean, why not just get rid of these terms?
Well, there is a good word that linguists use.
People just tend to use the word variety. Variety avoids the whole question entirely. Variety can be an accent. A variety can be sort of semi-dialect. A variety can be a full-on dialect. Variety kind of avoids you having to make that choice.
It's vague, bland. It kind of covers every eventuality. I guess that's okay. But it would also seem that some linguists might have a problem with it just because of its vagueness. What does it exactly describe?
Yeah, it's just everything. Although we could just call everything a dialect. But I think people would get
diplomatic.
I know. But when it comes down to it, I don't know that there's a good answer. And that's where we end today.
Language is politics.
Language is politics. And we didn't even bring up the one cliche this whole entire time.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Let's just...
Leave it at that.
Leave it at that.
You can subscribe to the World in Words podcast at Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to get your podcasts. Or you can tweet us at LingoPod.
And tomorrow, I'll be back with another never-before-heard-in-full podcast on the radio. This one is about Frank Zappa and the counterculture role he played on the other side of the Iron Curtain.
You don't want to miss that one. And Carol Hills will also be back with another worldly take on the day's happenings. Until then, from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Nina Porzuki.
And I'm Patrick Cox.
Happy Thanksgiving!
Public Radio International.